sorry. So I want to talk a little bit about the regulations that impact reproductive tourism. And I am part of a coalition called the Pro-Choice Alliance for Responsible Research, and we look at the intersection between reproductive justice and new reproductive technologies in the, as Lisa was pointing out, in the on the biotech side. So basically, I want to look at like what are basic elements of regulation, what are some models that are currently in effect. What are some new regulatory initiatives, and then what are some opportunities and challenges? So we've already heard a lot about this, so I don't want to spend much time, but like why regulate? And we're really looking at equity in the context of access and costs, availability. We know that much of reproductive tourism is driven by cost. We're looking at dignity. How do we balance the human rights of all parties and recognize that a very strict autonomy model ignores the fact that one person's reproductive decisions in this framework also impact somebody else's life? We are not making these decisions in a vacuum. And generally, as Emily already pointed out, the regulations are either non-existent or really inconsistent or just patchwork. And again, the result is a global cross-border baby making. And I'm really glad that Lisa also flagged the intersection with the rise of global biotech and the stem cell industry, which is having an effect on how regulation is even viewed. So the basic elements of any comprehensive regulatory scheme include safety and efficacy. In other words, is the treatment safe? Does it work? And Judy's going to talk more about that. Like, what are the types of procedures? So what are we talking about? Are we talking about pre-implantation genetic diagnosis? Are we talking about sex selection? Are we talking about surrogates? Are we talking about IVF? Another element is who is seeking the service. And one of the issues that has come up is many countries are restrictive about who can get certain services. And so that is also an impetus to cross-border baby making. There are countries that don't allow, for example, same-sex couples to hire a surrogate or don't allow single women to get IVF treatments. The other issue is really a legal issue, is parentage. So as we have different people contributing their genetic material, who are the legal parents? What are the rights and obligations of those parents? And then the financial considerations. Cost is obviously related to access, but also what kind of compensation is being offered and how, as Lisa was pointing out, how is that compensation a tool for exploitation or coercion or not? So one current model it's often held up is the UK. In the UK, the Human Fertilization Embryology Authority is a national agency that monitors and regulates, rulemakes, and enforces the government's positions on both artificial reproductive technologies and embryo research. Again, looking at that intersection. There are 21 members on this authority, and more than half of them have to be outside medicine or embryology. Unlike the situation that we see here in California with our Stem Cell Institute, where everybody at the table is an interested party, in the UK, there's a requirement that more than half of the people bring other kinds of broader expertise to the table. And the tasks, again, are regulation monitoring of IVF and embryo research, and they license all of the clinics and laboratories in the UK. They also have an interesting process of public consultations. It's slightly different than our regulatory process where people give public comment on regulations, but they have consultations where they try to bring in a broad cross-section of public thinking before they promulgate proposed regulations, and then those regulations go out for comment again, just kind of opens up the process. And what I'm going to talk about is what the way it looks right now and try to flag some changes that are actually before the Parliament as we speak. So first of all, it is comprehensive regulation. For example, they look at a limit of 2 embryo transfers per procedure, the idea to reduce the number of multiple births. One of the concepts that's now in the consultation process is whether this should be limited to 1. Part of this is very much related to not only preventing multiple births, but also safety of women. And Judy will talk about if you're not producing many, many eggs, you get fewer lower doses of hormones and other drugs. And so we're kind of looking at how do we ratchet down the system. Egg donors, also there's a huge issue as there's more and more people providing eggs for other women of siblings out there in the universe. So the each woman who provides eggs is limited to 10 families. It's actually 10 live births, and then the exception is for other children in the same family. And as is also already mentioned, there is a registry. So when you intend to marry, you can find out whether you're related to your intended, which is probably a good idea. There's a prohibition on social sex selection. In other words, there has to be a medical reason. So there are exceptions for certain genetic conditions. And this is an area where there's a lot of pushback to expand this. So they recently approved also genetic testing for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes and a colon cancer, a gene linked to colon cancer. So they really are moving away from a very narrow focus. And one of the things that is up for change is currently only married couples can hire surrogates. There also is a prohibition on commercialization. There's no advertising. There are no, unlike here in the U.S., where college papers have ads for women to sell their eggs for $100,000, there's no advertising there. The issue of parentage is really important there. In a surrogacy situation, the surrogate is actually the legal mother. And if she's married, her husband is a legal father. And so there is a process for transferring parental rights to the intended couple. There's a good system for data collection, which is something that's totally missing in the United States. You may know that the CDC collects data only on birth outcomes. So, and whether it was fresh eggs or frozen eggs, or whether it was your own eggs or somebody else's eggs, but there's no other data that's collected in terms of health impact or who's giving eggs or how that process is going forward. And the access piece is really interesting. So unlike most insurance coverage here, the National Health Service does cover IVF. Unfortunately, though, it's very limited to a medical model. So you have to have either identified reason for your infertility or been trying to get pregnant for two years. And as you can see, the age group also is a very limited age group. Canada also has just recently enacted its own regulatory system. And it is just in the process now of kind of fleshing out what the regulations will look like. But They also are looking at it from a very comprehensive perspective, and this is really due to the advocacy of the Canadian Women's Health Network and other women's health advocates in Canada. And they also look at both artificial reproductive technologies and embryo research, and it's very similar in that sense to the UK system. Again, egg donors are not paid, although they do allow reasonable expenses. So where in the U.S., as Lisa pointed out, we have this two-tier system, in Canada it's the same, but in Canada they prohibit the creation of new embryos for research altogether. It's a prohibition on social sex selection. They also, surrogacy there too is legal. To contrast that with the United States, we have no real laws about surrogacy generally. Mostly there have been court cases that have been decided questions about legal parenting, et cetera, in a surrogacy situation. And here, surrogacy is basically just a matter of contract. Again, they prohibit brokers. And access, IVF is covered in the Canadian health system. The limits of coverage vary by province. So we want to talk about some new regulatory models. You already heard a lot about India, where these technologies are basically unregulated. India has been confronting the challenge of tremendous sex selection and a decrease in the number of girls, trying to have moved from a lot of infanticide of little girls to a sex selection process, which perhaps on a continuum, one has to think about how we feel about sex selection generally. And so they have enacted laws to prohibit social sex selection. There prohibits an ultrasound to determine the sex of a child. If you have an ultrasound for another reason, the sex of the child is not to be revealed to the parents. And there are no sex selective, abortion is illegal for the purpose of sex selection. And there's a lot of tension around that. So how does the attempt to regulate also impact on other rights, which is a tremendous challenge. And in the surrogacy case, I was just thinking there, Oprah had something on surrogacy. If we talk about what's in the public media. There's been 150% increase in the number of surrogate births in the past 2 years in India. And as Emily already pointed out, it's a multi-million dollar industry. Recently, though, there was a case of baby Manji. What happened was a Japanese couple came to India, hired a surrogate, used the man's sperm and a donor egg, and when they went back to Japan, their marriage didn't last, and they wound up getting a divorce. So the mother did not want the child, but the father did. And this sparked a national debate because India, first of all, does not allow single-parent adoption. So the child cannot be transferred from the surrogate to the father because he wasn't married. And Japan won't allow an immigration visa, unless there's a record of adoption. So you had the conflicts in these two laws. The child wound up being given to a guardian because the surrogate, her responsibilities ended at childbirth. And you know, it really was it sparked an opportunity for a national debate about surrogacy in India. And the result of it is proposed legislation that at one level will add some regulation, some accountability, data collection, et cetera. It makes it clear who the parents are. It makes it clear that the child can be taken to the intended parent's home country. But it also has sparked a huge response from women's health and justice advocates because all it does is legalize a system that is in place now. Does nothing to rein it in, does nothing about expenses, it does nothing to really protect the women who become surrogates. And so they're seeing it as an opportunity to really push for much more comprehensive legislation, and we'll see where that goes. Another regulatory initiative is in the European Union. The European Society for Human Reproduction and Embryology has created task forces on various aspects. They have one on IVF. They have had one on assisted reproduction. But now they're looking at kind of the broader, can there be a regulatory system through all of the EU that will create consistency, that will kind of stop the cross-border traffic that happens within the EU. And some of the things that they're looking at are access to treatment and how access barriers lead to reproductive tourism, how to both establish and enforce quality standards internationally, how to educate the public so that people are making informed decisions before they enter into agreements or seek these kinds of reproductive technologies, and how to establish professional accountability, which in terms of licensing or oversight and data collection. So what are some of the opportunities and challenges for regulation? Well, it's really hard, and it's really tricky. One of the models could be the EU task force. Another model to look at is other types of, someone mentioned already, international adoption, looking at whether do we want regulation, do we want guidelines. In the stem cell context, we have the International Society for Stem Cell Research that has international guidelines, but they, of course, have no sense of, they have no enforcement. Do we want to think about this in terms of trade agreements? Do we want, I'm not endorsing NAFTA when I say NAFTA, but do we want to be looking at, as we enter into cross-national agreements, do we want to be thinking about how reproductive tourism fits into that? And we want to hold on to a human rights approach, which really challenges, as I said, a very narrow autonomy frame, but really looks at who are all the parties involved and how do we respect the human rights of all parties. The challenges, of course, are who's at the table. What we're seeing in the UK is there's more and more biotech interests at the table, and so the women's health and justice voices are not as loud as they used to be. How do we achieve health justice through this process, balancing regulation with a respect for family formation? And again, the complicated intersection between abortion rights, family formation, and the interests of stem cell research and biotech, and how they're pushing back on any types of regulations. So no one is suggesting that this is going to be easy or even feasible, but having a global conversation, now that we have a global healthcare system, if you will, is a step in the right direction to make sure that we're both respecting rights and public health. Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes.
Do you know if there's any information on the impact of the regulations, for example, in the UK when they put their regulations into place? And I'm also wondering if there's also been media attention to plastic surgery tourism and some of the other events in the global health system. Are there any parallels for how people are thinking about regulating or addressing? Obviously, there are different issues, but are those discussions linked into some of these discussions, or are those discussions not happening?
I think that in the answer to your first question, unfortunately, some of the restrictive aspects of the UK regulation are actually contributing factors to reproductive tourism. So a same-sex couple, for example, can't hire a surrogate in the UK, so they have to go somewhere else. This question of eggs and how many are there, and also a shortage of eggs. Is that because there's no payment? Is that, you know, we don't know why? Also is leading to reproductive tourism. So, you know, in a better world, and maybe if some of the changes, especially in terms of who has access to these treatments, changes, that will lessen some of the pressure. But in terms of the intersection, you know, it's really interesting. People react in a lot of different ways. So there are U.S. healthcare insurers who are actually contributing by saying, oh, yes, we'll pay for it. Go to India and get your your heart transplant, and it'll be cheaper there. And so we'll even cover the cost of your flight. So when you have only a market-driven decision-making process, we are actually seeing on that end not only condoning of it, but some encouragement. And so I don't think we know how this is, until we solve the issue of access to quality health care generally, which drives much of this, we don't even know. If there was access to universal access to health care, we don't know how many people would then feel they didn't need to travel. But I think that's a big unknown. Well, thank you. Our last presenter is Judy Nursijian. And